'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
In my mind,
sounds sick.
Thank you.
to remember this land.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas
to all of you.
And we mean it now.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas
to all of you.
Merry Christmas from the Temptations.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Warner Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks. All right. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio, WTTTY, internet radio all around the world radio. And I'm your host, George Wilder Jr. You can follow me on Facebook, Blog Talk, right here. LinkedIn, Instagram, is what else? Yahoo. Okay. I'm all over the place, 347-857-1762, or just sit back and relax and enjoy the show. Okay, my guest is author Marnie Grundman, okay? And folks, it's another cold blast. I mean, all weekend has been cold. However, the Bears game, they were touting before Sunday's Bears game that it was going to be the coldest game in Bears history. I mean, that's all we heard here in Chicago for a week leading up to Sunday, which was yesterday, at the taping of this show. It was yesterday. Folks, I'm here to tell you, we did not get anywhere near it. Anywhere near being the coldest in history at Soldier Field on Sunday, as the weather forecasters all over the place were touting, scaring us to death, keeping people away from the game, saying that the players should actually cover up. They shouldn't be out there with their arms all out because it was going to be a mess. 30 below zero, 40 below, two below, whatever. It never got there. The weather people, no doubt about it, egg on their face, but they always find a good way to get out of it. They either by not mentioning it or blaming it on something else, like their modules or models or whatever. But it is cold, folks. It is totally, totally cold. And it will continue to be cold. Winter is officially, I believe, 2 or 3 days from now. But think about all those weeks before where it was so damn cold and winter was 2 or 3, 4 weeks away. But anyway, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We're frigid here, but we're going to do it. It's been one cold ass fall or year, whatever you want to call it. It's been really zippity-doo-dah day when it comes to frost. And as I say every day on this show, cover up. I mean, you're going to have to bundle up, folks. You cannot go out there in shorts and t-shirts and leggings. You're going to have to bundle up. You're going to freeze your ass off. And some people are fine with that. You're going to have to put on a cap or a hood. You can just look at some of the people who hate that. They just can't stand covering up. You know, I'm too beautiful to cover up. I got too much to show. I'm going to mess up my hair. I'm going to freeze to death because I'm pretty. You have to cover up out there. You have to. This is dangerous cold. This cold has taken lives already. But you're going to have, you're always going to have stupid people. I mean, people who just can't think, people who are illogical, people who are just totally brain dead. You're going to have those kind of people and they're not going to dress. So, you know, you can't worry about that. You can't worry about things you cannot control. If people don't want to dress for the cold weather, then that's their problem. you know, but this show is all about making the world a better place, one show at a time, and making the world a better place is that you don't get sick, that you don't get the flu, and take it back to the office or to school and give it to others around you. And that's what this show is about, you know, but people can do what the hell they want to do. If you want to get sick by not dressing properly for the cold, then that's on you. But there's nothing wrong with the George Wilder Jr. show mentioning it and throwing it out there. But for those of you who do cover up from this frosty and Arctic weather, thumbs up for you, okay? Because you're doing the right thing. I know you see a lot of people out there too with nothing on their heads, hair down to, you know, their shoulders, thinking they're cute and fine, leggings. I know you freezing your ass off when you wear those things out here in 20 and 10 and 2 below zero. But they try to act like they're not. Okay, glad to be back. We were off for 3 days. We always be off for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We're going to take some time off to recoup, relax, and do some writing. And we're back Monday. It's Monday the 19th. We're back on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And thank you for being out there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all your accolades and your emails and your inboxes and your responses to the show, whether negative or positive. I'm always hoping it will be negative. It would be positive. Excuse me. It would be positive. Your feedback would be positive. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. You know, with all this damn cold and the holidays are here. With all this damn cold and the holidays are here, violence never rests. We've had over the weekend, in Chicago alone, we've had 40 shootings. The criminals say the hell with the holiday. The dirtbags, the thugs, they say, I'm going out here and I'm going to shoot somebody. I don't give a damn how cold it is. Yeah, so, but if when I think about it, it could have been a much higher count. There could have been more shootings. But in my heart, I do believe that the cold weather keeps some of the bad guys off the street, off the corners, preying on young girls or preying on the elderly. I do think that some of these guys are off the streets. You know, I do think that. It's not a funny, but I do think that. But still in all, violence is just, you know, it's just something that's ingrained into the society here in the city of Chicago and elsewhere. You know, violence is just awful. I mean, you got in Berlin, Germany, trucks plow into a crowd at Christmas market, killing, I believe, 70-something people, if I got that right. But anyway, I know people did die. And that's awful. At Christmas time, violence all around the world. People are dying. It doesn't make sense. And also in Turkey, shocking attack in Turkey. Russian ambassador assassinated on camera. Violence is just rampant during Christmas, during the holidays. It doesn't take a rest. People still die. People are dying. And I'm just mentioning two incidents here, current. But what about all those people who are dying? Being criminally assaulted, robbed. What about all the people that I can't call out their names that are being sexually assaulted? What about all the domestic violence? Things that are going on right now as I speak. I don't have their names, but I do know that these things are happening and these things are going on. And it's Christmas. It's Christmas. But the violence just does not quit. It does not take a back seat. It does not stop or halt for anything. The police, the politicians can't seem to get a handle on this, you know, but they're getting paid people, but they can't seem to do it. And they don't seem to have any plans or solutions, you know. But they're always having smiles on their faces while people are getting shot down. And this is supposed to be the season of giving. And what are people are getting? A bullet. They're getting violence. They're getting thrown out of their shelters or evicted from their apartments or losing their homes. Yeah, that's really happening. People are losing their homes, whether it's through fire or through foreclosure or through eviction. Out in this cold, that's got to be, you know, devastating for families to be out in the damn cold. Some people are lucky. They may have a little put away in the bank and they can kind of, you know, get back up on their feet by finding somewhere to stay. But a lot of people do not have bank accounts. People do not save money like they used to, maybe because they can't. Everything is just going up, 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 up. Inflation is just, you know, if you walk in the store, you get a box of cereal, you find out that that box of cereal that you've been buying for years has now been scaled down. It's smaller, it's thinner. And it costs more. Everything is going up. People can't afford it. People can't buy it. But you know what? They don't give a damn. The food manufacturers, they don't give a damn if you can't afford something that you used to be able to afford because they have jacked up the prices. They don't give a damn. You either buy it or you starve. That's their point of view. Your rent goes up, you know, from, you know, $600 a month to $1,500 a month. The landlord doesn't give a shit. You either pay it or you leave. And that's the way of the world during the holidays, 2016. The shelter located in Uptown in Chicago, a couple of them, or two or three of them, are closing their doors. Closing their doors 2 days before Christmas. And in this cold-ass weather, they're throwing people out. Say, hey, we got to go. We don't have any money. But the mayor of the city of Chicago, and I've said this before, this guy, he can find money for illegals. People who are here illegal. He can find money for to keep the sanctuary cities open, the sanctuary churches open. These are churches who are harboring the illegals. He can find money for the refugees. He's always saying the city is broke. But for what he wants to accomplish and for what he wants, he finds money to do that. Now, this guy is all in for the refugees. I mean, and the illegals, the people who come here or were brought here, but they're not American citizens. He's all for keeping Chicago a sanctuary city, protecting them. And he's coming up with money to do it. But ask him to come up with money to save these two or three shelters that are about to close and people are homeless. Americans are homeless. The city is broke. That's the first thing he'll say. That's the first thing that the governor of Illinois would say. Well, we're broke. But they can always come up with money for anything that they want. You know, but if it has anything to do with people, citizens, Americans, they can't find it. The city is broke. But they can find money to keep Chicago a sanctuary city, housing illegals, finding money to give them a place to live, finding money to give them food stamps, finding money to give them welfare. But yet they can't seem to find money to save these shelters, these needed shelters for these families. It just I know they can come up with all kind of excuses to why they can't find money. What is too much? We don't have that much. But they can come, they can do this. A lot of the social programs around the city have been shut down or shutting down because there's no money. At least they claim it. They claim there's no money. But when if push comes to shove, they'll find it. They will find it. But this is why coming in a couple of years, we got to vote these people out of office. Chicagoans, we got to vote them out because they're just about themselves. They're not about the city. They're about their own personal wants. Not about yours or mine or anyone. Their own personal wants. The mayor and the governor. You know, the mayor is a Democrat. The governor is a Republican, and I'm neither. I changed my affiliation years ago, and I'm proud, and I will never go back. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. I believe we will be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for tuning in to the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right, the incoming controller of the Illinois legislature, I think her name is Mendoza. She's a Democrat. Susanna Mendoza. She just beat one of the Republicans for that office. And now she is complaining that they've stolen or taken everything from the office. You know, they've taken everything. She's okay. The newly elected president. No, that's not what we want. Okay, all right. Okay, now it says here, I'm reading, folks. So if I goof up, it's because I'm reading. Now add Susan Mendoza to the list of victorious who are not happy with the way their predecessors left their offices. Okay, she's saying that the former controller, Leslie Munger, she was ousted. And so by being ousted, she just stripped the office of everything. Because Susan Mendoza, she has to work in that office. And the only thing that they left was probably the desk. And she's saying they probably left the desk. They probably left the desk behind because it was too heavy to move. So she's complaining about, you know, the way they have. Well, was mad and pissed off that she won. This is the way Republicans do. I mean, if Democrat wins, they try to do everything they can to make it atrocious for them. To make it difficult for them. You know, I mean, you take this governor, I mean, in North Carolina, Democratic governor who just been governor-elect, just voted into office. The Republicans are trying to strip him of his power. This is what Republicans do. They just step and smash on Democrats, especially when Democrats beat them and their money fails them. So now she's complaining, but you know what? If you talk to Leslie Munger, the former controller, and you talk to the governor, who are both Republicans in the state of Illinois, you get all kinds of excuses. You would get totally, totally all kinds of excuses. But she's complaining, she's bitching about them taking everything and leaving her with nothing, and she's got to do the work of a comptroller. I'm glad she won. I, you know, because one of the reasons why I'm glad, and I think other people are glad she won the office, is because we want to let Republicans know that their money do not always get them elected. They have to do something for the people. They have to earn that vote. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad that she won. But still in all, she won, but she claimed that they stole everything from the office. Well, she's a comptroller. She's making money. She can buy that stuff again and have herself a really, really great office down there in the state of Illinois, down there in Springfield, Illinois. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. I want to say, folks, in Chicago, it is cold as hell. We're freezing. Well, when I was out there earlier, it was freezing. And I want to reiterate again, Soldier Field was not the coldest as they were touting. It didn't get anywhere. So therefore, the weathercasters were wrong in that instance. They have egg on their face. But I'm pretty sure they're going to try and get out of it by saying, well, it was the modules, the monitors, you know. So it is cold, but there's no doubt about it. It's cold and it's a cold one, folks. All right, let's go to the phone. Seems like we have... Okay. All right. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. You are on the air.
Hi, George. It's Marnie Grunman. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for doing the show. Okay. Tell us a little bit something
Thank
about
you for
yourself.
Having
give
me.
Us a little bio. No problem. Give us a little bio and tell us about your book.
Well, my book is called Missing, A True Story of a Childhood Lost, and it is my story. I went missing at the age of 13 and stayed gone until I was 17 and a half. I was actually a runaway. I started running away when I was 5 years old from a very abusive home, and I'm on a mission to raise awareness for other runaways like me so that people understand that children that run away aren't bad. They come from bad environments.
Yeah. Wow, that is something. And so this book is basically about you running away. During your time on the run, what were some of the things that you did to stay safe and to survive on your own?
Well, sometimes I unfortunately didn't stay so safe. In the beginning, I lived on park benches, on the beach. I was in Miami initially ran away, and in abandoned buildings and things of that nature. Runaways tend to find each other, fortunately, and I hooked up with another girl who had been on the streets longer than I had, and she kind of showed me the ropes, and that was a really good thing for me because I don't know what would have happened had I not met this girl. And eventually I managed to find a job. I mean, by the time I was 14 years old, I actually got hired as a cocktail waitress. And from that point on, I was mostly able to provide for myself and, you know, have a roof over my head and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the story is similar to the one I myself experienced. I mean, I was, younger at a younger age, much younger. I think I was around 16. And I was homeless. I mean, I didn't run away, but I was homeless. And I told myself that I was going to make it. I was going to do this. I was going to get up off the streets. I was going to make something of myself. I wasn't going to let this hold me back. And I didn't. I like you, I found a job being out on the streets. I found a job, and the rest is history.
Yeah, you know, sometimes we get lucky. Unfortunately, that's not the case with a lot of runaways. I think that for runaways, about 42% of them end up in prostitution because they're hungry. I mean, you go 3 or 4 days without food, you've been homeless, you know the desperation that could set in there. I was lucky not to be one of them. And now in this day and age with what's happening with sex trafficking, the statistic is, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, in 2015, 1 in 5 runaways was sold into sex trafficking. So the ones who actually may have a way to come home or would want to come home, which may not be so many, many times can't because they're being held against their will. So they're extremely endangered and vulnerable, right?
I totally agree with you. How did you, weren't you, I mean, sleeping on park benches, weren't you a little bit apprehensive about that? I mean, your life could have been in, real, real danger sleeping on park benches. I've slept on a park bench once myself. I didn't feel any fear sleeping on a park bench. I only slept one night. How did you feel sleeping on a park bench?
You know, I think as is with a lot of children of abuse, we learn how to numb out at such a young age to survive what's happening to us, that fear isn't something that necessarily enters the equation. You know, I remember particular times I was afraid, but none of them related to the park bench. It was more like common sense. Like when I slept in an abandoned building, I would have my back up against the wall. I didn't sleep laying down, and I would sleep near like a fire escape or a doorway or something where I could make a quick exit. I think my sense wasn't fear as much as it was embarrassment. I had a healthy feeling of shame at all times, and I think that was more my focus, unfortunately.
Yeah, I recall. I wasn't a runaway. I was kind of kicked out, okay? And I was seeking revenge for the people who did that by making, by doing something positive as to get up off the streets. And it was, I even wrote about it. I'm a writer too. So I wrote about that in an autobiography, about how it all began and how it all started. But I never was a runaway. I was just kicked out there, bing, you know. So do you think there's a difference from being kicked out and onto the streets or just being a runaway? Is there a correlation or no?
Well, I can't imagine if you were kicked out on the streets, you came from a loving home. So my thought would be.
No. I didn't come from a loving home. That's why I was kicked out.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it's any different. I think it's, you know, I'm not sure if it's better or worse, you know, and I always say that I never measure myself or my pain or my past against somebody else's, because everybody's experience is valid, obviously.
Different. Yeah.
And it's just different. I mean, for me, looking at a child who was actually kicked out, that feels worse to me. I left voluntarily in a way, even though I was forced out, but that's not what I think my mother thought would happen. I don't think she thought I'd stay gone for 3.5 years. Not that she was unhappy about it. She wouldn't have kicked me out just because it would have looked bad. Had she been able to, she probably would have. So I don't think the experience is any different.
I was kicked out, and I was gone for 5 years. It would have been a lot more if they hadn't found me.
Me too. Damn them.
So you
about it all now.
Yeah. You've written a book about this, and you've written a book about your experiences, and you're hoping that this book will help other people who are or were in your situation.
Yeah, and not just runaways. I mean, of course, one of my main objectives is to raise awareness for them, because there's so many people out there that just feel, somebody made a statement to me today. I had an interview earlier, and they said, you know, when they use the word runaway, people's response is, oh, they're just looking for attention. Well, yeah, no kidding. They're looking for attention because something's wrong at home. So my first goal is that. My second goal, or maybe simultaneous goal, is to help people that are struggling to heal from any sort of trauma, whether it's child abuse, physical, sexual, or emotional, or anything else along the way. I had a lot of terrible things that were done to me, particularly by my mother, and I'm here to say that I broke the cycles with my children, and all this time later, I am healed. I am better than healed, you know, and so I want to give hope to people, and I want the parents of the missing who do want their children back to know how to deal with those children that come back. I want the kids who ran away, who are struggling to find themselves and to absolve themselves from the things that they had to do, to know that they're not alone and that they did what they did because they needed to survive, and it's okay.
Yeah. My mother, you know, I mean, I never actually forgave her for some of the things that she's done. And, you know, raising my own kids, I would never, ever kick my kid out into the street. And I don't think my kids would think about running away, as I had thought many times, and or being forced out like I was. Just like you, I was forced out. But everything was always my fault. You know, they blamed it all on me. You know, it was my fault. I caused it, you know, and I did not. But that was their excuse. And do you ever feel that it was your fault by this happening to you?
Now, no. But my whole life growing up, and many years after, it was actually, I didn't start to release myself from the burden of responsibility until I was in my early 20s. Having children helped do that, because as you know, when we see our children at those particular times where things were really bad and we realize how vulnerable and small they are, it's a very healing thing. And also, I had to go through therapy. I mean, I was the scapegoat for the family. I was the bad one. I was the one, because I was running away, I threatened the perfect picture that now people would know something was wrong in our household. And because of that, I was ostracized. It was better to cast me out than to fix what was wrong and take public responsibility. And that's very common in abusive families.
Yeah, I was also ostracized. I was also ostracized, and that's one of the worst feelings in the world, when everybody in your family slams the door on you, you know, like you Agreed. Don't belong, like you shouldn't exist. What are you doing here? You know, it was hurtful. And I don't think they knew that I was hurt. I'm pretty sure that they didn't care. And what are you talking about here? Just bringing back so many memories of years and years ago, decades ago, maybe. But I wrote about it, and I try. And you know what? I used to have nightmares about this. Did you ever have nightmares about the situations that were happening to you at a younger age? I've had nightmares about it. I mean,
oh yeah. Wow. Well, when I started to go through therapy in particular, I went mm-hmm. through, like, I think I was 25 maybe, and I went through about 2.5 years. There were times I mm-hmm. didn't want to go to sleep because I was afraid of what I was going to be dreaming or what the nightmares were going to be.
Yeah.
It was like I was yeah. reliving everything. Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah, you...
and that's another reason that I wrote the book, because that's now a vague memory for me, which is so great, because I remember being in the middle of that and really thinking, I am never going to get through this. I am never going to be okay. And the truth of the matter is that I'm more than okay. But you don't feel that way when you're in the middle of it, you know?
Yeah. I've always said, I'm going to take this memory to my grave. I'm going to, it's going to, because, you know, it's just something I can't forget. I try, but then it just seeps back into your thoughts and you just feel bad about it. You get emotional, you know, and you know that you can't be emotional all the time because you got to go on with your life. You got to put it in the back of your mind. It'll never be totally, off your mind, but you can put it in the back of your mind. It'll be there because it happened to you. It happened to you.
Yeah.
And it's going to be there, but not at the forefront of your mind, because you're going to have things to do. Do you have an excerpt that you can read from your book?
I do. Let me just open it here. Mm-hmm. It's just a couple of paragraphs.
Okay. No problem.
I hated it when I ended up sleeping in the sauna alone. It was terrifying. We wouldn't go into them until after 9 or 10 at night to be sure no one was using them. Sometimes I could hear people coming and I was afraid they would kick me out, leaving me unable to find Lori. I remember one night that was particularly cold. Our bag that was hidden in the paneling was missing and I had nothing soft to put my head on. No clothes to cover me for warmth other than what I had on. I attempted to work the sauna for the heat, but I didn't know how. So I lay there alone on the wooden slats, shivering in the dark, weeping. At first, I began to cry for my mother. True story, I began to cry for the evil one. I wanted her to rescue me. I wanted her to love me. I wondered out loud if she even remembered who I was. Slowly, I came to my senses and began whispering to my daddy in heaven to please help me. I believed he was the only one who could and the only one who would care. A dead man, nothing left but soul and ashes. Thoughts of my daddy soothed me, focused me. I decided that I was going through this hell as a kind of prepayment for a good life. From a very young age, I always knew that better days lay ahead. Now I had an explanation as to why. I was paying up front. I decided that I was destined for greatness and that I just had to power through. That was from a period of time when I was living in a sauna in an abandoned in an apartment complex with another runaway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So are you? That's powerful. I mean, that is totally powerful. So where can we find this book? I mean, is it published somewhere?
Yes, it is. So there's a couple of places you can find it. One is on my website, mm-hmm. which is Marnie, M-A-R-N-I-E, Grundman, G-R-U. ndman.com. And I also do a lot of other writing there and consulting to help people get through their damage. And you can find it on Amazon as well, and it's available in Kindle.
Oh, no problem. No problem. I'll be downloading it. Are you planning on to do any more writing? Are you planning on to do any more writing in this genre?
This is my only genre, I think. There will be a second book because even though the book is finished, there's some other experiences that need to be written about. And I write I write articles and blogs, not just for my own website, but for other publications as well. And I do some relationship and love blogs as well.
Okay.
Full time.
Okay. Marty Grundman on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Hey, it's been nice having you. Merry Christmas. I hope to have you back on the show. Thank you so much. Before
Thank
you
so
go,
much.
would you like a link of this show? You can put it on your website. People can,
Absolutely.
People who love the book and love you and come by and listen to you on the show. Okay, we'll get that to you in about 2 hours. Okay, we'll get that to you in about 2 hours. Thanks for being on the show.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, author Marty Grundman on the George Wilder Jr. Show, Runaway. Sounds like a great book. Sounds like a wonderful book. You guys go out there and you get that book and you learn about being a runaway from someone who has experienced it. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Let's see if we can do this musical break right now.
My son has been arrested for walking while black.
A lot of sons have been arrested.
Yeah, I get it. It doesn't make me, you know, you can't buy your way out of this one. You can't educate your way out of it.
It's happening too much, or at least we know about it now.
It's always happened. We see more evidence of it. And too often people still are inclined to say, well, if he'd had a different attitude, well, if he hadn't been driving, well, if he hadn't been this, if he hadn't been that, almost as if the victim is partially to blame You know, in the case of Garner, well, he shouldn't have resisted. In the case of Brown, well, where was he? In the case of Trayvon, well, he had a hood on, you know, and in the case of whoever, you know, in case of Sandra Bland, you know, well, her attitude was bad. It's like, no, stop. Stop. This has nothing to do with the victims. This has everything to do with the culture of demeaning a person of color. And there is no justification for society where my son has a far greater chance of being stopped, held, killed than your son, simply because he's black.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Black Talk Radio.
Well, President Donald Trump, you know, he has been officially voted in as president. The electors, the electoral votes, they voted for this guy. So Donald Trump will be our 45th president. That is no doubt about it. He's going to be sworn in, I think, on January 22nd of 2017. So Donald Trump is the president of the United States. There's no doubt about it. And that's what I think all these people who are trying to get the electoral college to change their vote, to switch their votes to someone else, somewhere else, they ought to just go check themselves. This man won. He's got the he had 306 electoral votes to Hillary's, I believe, 232. So, I mean, if he screws up, he screws up. If he succeeds, he succeeds. Let him at least try. Trump is talking about 8 years, and he hasn't even done 1 year yet. He'll be 80, I believe, when his term is up, if he does 8 years as president of the United States. But anyway, a lot of the they voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump Electoral College on this day, the 19th of December. People thought that they were going to do something different, but they, you know, voted for him. So against Hillary Clinton and against President Obama. Hillary won the popular vote, but Donald Trump won the electoral vote. And even in the Constitution of the United States, it's saying that the electoral vote, you know, outpaces the popular vote, which I disagree with. I totally disagree with. I've been thinking for a long ass time, I mean, years ago, that the electoral vote is a sham. The popular vote, you counting the people. Why doesn't the people? I mean, it's like if you vote, it doesn't count because it counts some way, though, you know, but it's still not fair. I think a lot of us think that the popular vote should stand, even if it's a Republican, even if it's a Democrat, no matter who runs. It should be the popular vote that wins, that puts a candidate in office. The popular vote. But that's just me. But it's in the Constitution. In order for that to happen, you would have to, you know, amend the Constitution of the United States. And the Republicans aren't going to do that because the electoral vote, the electoral college vote favored them. Whatever favors the Republicans, they're going to go for it. You know, so, but I was critical of the electoral vote for years, not just because Hillary lost or Obama lost this, but it's in the Constitution. In order for it to be changed, you have to amend the Constitution. The Republicans control the White House. The Republicans control Congress. So therefore, it's not going to happen because it benefited them. And there's people out here right now pleading with the Republicans not to eliminate Obamacare. They're pleading with the Republicans, Donald Trump and Congress. And we all thought before the election that that the Democrats were going to win the House, that the Democrats was going to win the Senate. They were all saying that the Dems had a chance. They were saying that Hillary had a chance. All these people were wrong. Even the media were wrong. The pundits were wrong. The news reporters, the news sites, outlets, the internet was all wrong. No matter how you slice it, they were wrong. Even if the Russians interfered and helped win the election, they were still wrong. They were still wrong. This was so grossly wrong. It just, they got it all wrong. News sites and reporters and journalists that we depend on for our news, they got it all wrong. They had us thinking that Hillary was going to get this thing's hand down. And when she didn't, so many people were heartbroken. They were crying. They couldn't believe it. So Trump is president. Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States. Live with it. We're going to have to live with it. There's people out here who are bitching, crying, protesting him, still protesting him. There's nothing you can do. Even if Donald Trump drops dead, you're going to have Mike Pence. And Mike Pence may be a lot worse than Donald Trump. Oh, if Donald Trump gets impeached, you got Mike Pence. And he's a lot worse than Donald Trump from what I've been reading and what I've been told. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. Folks, it is cold. And I hope it's warm where you are. They're saying that the only state in the country that's warm is Florida. I am so jealous. People walking around the beach with bathing suits on and shorts and jumping in the water and flocking at the beach. Not here. Not here. They're flocking. If they're here, they're flocking to a coffee shop to get some coffee to warm up inside. Wow. Like I was saying earlier, folks, 40 people shot in Chicago. No matter how cold it is, violence never ever quits. I have a feeling that if it wasn't really cold outside the polar vortex, that more people would have been shot. 40, because there have been known to be 60 to 70 people shot during the weekend. And it's just no matter how cold it is. And it just behooves me, baffles me to why the police department can't seem to come up with any solution or any plan to quell the violence in the city of Chicago, probably elsewhere throughout the country. It just baffles me. And these guys get paid, you know. And the thing about it makes it so bad, doubly bad, is that it is the holidays. Christmas is coming up in a few, actually next week, next Sunday, from the date of this show. And it just behooves me, but that these guys can't get out here in the streets and catch these bad guys. There are so many bad guys who have committed crime in the city of Chicago who have not been apprehended. They're not caught. If they're not caught or apprehended, they're out here to do it again. You don't get these people off the street, they're out here to do it again. And the police, they just seem to just fail in every category. However, they can always get their asses on television and say that they're doing the best that they can and blaming someone else for it, for the crime. But, you know, they never seem to solve any of this, you know, and or stop it. 40 people shot over the weekend. That's crazy. In the cold. I don't know. It never quits. You know, it never quits. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. We are going to do this right now. We'll be right back.
The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. It is all about making the world a better place. Join me.
president, not the president that made a speech last night where everybody fell asleep and what he said. Hey, look. So what happens, and what Obama was saying, President Obama, because we have to treat him with respect, right? Yes? Just think of this. So you have a president who's African-American. Good, I love that. Except less has been done for African-Americans than anybody. They're having one of the worst times they've ever had. African-American youth.
That actually ripped, not from the headlines.
Watching our guests.
Not ripped
that.
From the headlines. It actually ripped from the mouth of Tavis Smiley yesterday, who basically said the same thing.
Let's see where this conversation goes. Joining us now, chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, Eddie Gloud Jr. He's the author of the new book, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Also with us, President and CEO of the National Urban League, Mark Morial. Good to have you both on the show.
Thank you guys so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book.
Wow. Is this Pub Day?
Yesterday.
Oh, you'll pop right now.
Slow clap.
Let's go.
So
do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys, performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008, and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter" to "Black lives matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%. and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out four measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse, and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. Young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low-status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation, were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people, from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of non-violent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while overall, 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty, this number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. US Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across the Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulties have an adverse effect on parents' emotions, behaviors, and relationships, which affect their parenting or socialization strategies. According to the model, the emotional distress of poverty predicts conflict and reduces warmth and support in parent-child relationships. These relationship disruptions contribute to children's emotional and behavioral problems, academic failures, and poor cognitive functioning. The investment model suggests that economic resources increase the investment parents are able to make in their children's development, promoting academic and social competencies. With increased resources, parents are able to invest in the development of their children, providing the special care, time, and services necessary to support their children's emotional needs. These investments contribute to enriched learning environments, higher standards of living, and safer homes and neighborhoods. Greater family resources appear to reduce risks associated with the stress of poverty and help create environments that promote competent development. Instability is another key factor in the emotional well-being and intellectual growth of a child. A 2013 study called The Negative Effects of Instability on Child Development, a Research Synthesis, describes the effects of poverty and instability. Children thrive in stable and nurturing environments where they have a routine and know what to expect. Although some change in children's lives is normal and anticipated, sudden and dramatic disruptions can be extremely stressful and affect children's feeling of security. Within the context of supportive relationships with adults who act as a buffer against any negative effects of instability, children learn how to cope with adversity, adapt to their surroundings, and regulate their emotions. When parents lack choice or control over change, they may be less likely to support their children in adapting to the change. Unbuffered stress that escalates to extreme levels can be detrimental to children's mental health and cognitive functioning. The experience of economic instability causes increased material hardship, particularly when families lack personal assets. Low family income negatively affects children's social, emotional, cognitive, and academic outcomes, even after controlling for parental characteristics. Children's cognitive development during early childhood is most sensitive to the experience of low family income. Parental employment instability is linked to negative academic outcomes, such as grade retention, lower educational attainment, and internalized and externalizing behaviors. The effect on grade retention is strongest for children with parents in a high school education or less, whereas the effect on educational attainment is stronger for blacks than whites, males, and firstborn children. In dual-income households, the father's job loss might be more strongly related to children's academic outcomes than the mother's job loss. Job instability leads to worse child behavioral outcomes than when a parent voluntarily changes jobs, works low-wage jobs full-time, or has fluctuating work hours. Family instability is linked to problem behaviors and some academic outcomes, even at early ages. Children's problem behaviors further increase with multiple changes in family structure. Family transitions that occur early in children's development, prior to age 6, and in adolescence, appear to have the strongest effects. While young children need constant caregivers with whom they can form secure attachments, adolescents need parental support, role models, and continuity of residence and schools to succeed. Children demonstrate more negative behaviors when they lack the emotional and material support at home that they need to smoothly handle a family transition. Poverty is bad for children's emotional and cognitive development, and poverty is more likely to be the consequence of single-parent households. The next factor to consider is the subculture many of these young people are inculcated into. It should be no surprise that large numbers of delinquent, impoverished young men with poor education and lacking in fatherly role models would find acceptance within criminal gangs. In 2012, it was estimated that there were 30,000 gangs operating within the United States, with over 800,000 members. Blacks make up over 35% of these gangs, while whites make up less than 12%. These gangs are, of course, predominantly young men. and they are mostly located in large cities. Gang violence accounts for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime. Gangs are responsible for an average of 48% of violent crime in most jurisdictions, and up to 90% in several others. Major cities and suburban areas experience the most gang-related violence. Local, neighborhood-based gangs and drug crews continue to pose the most significant criminal threat in most communities. Aggressive recruitment of juveniles and immigrants, alliances and conflict between gangs, the release of incarcerated gang members from prison, advancements in technology and communication, and Mexican drug trafficking organization involvement in drug distribution have resulted in gang expansion and violence in a number of jurisdictions. As covered earlier, black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder at 51.3%, robbery at 55.9%, and gambling at 58.9%, and was significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes at 40.7%, prostitution and vice at 41.8%, and aggravated assault at 33.1%. These are all common gang activities, and are without a doubt raising the resulting statistics for black crime. You may have noticed that the statistics for black crime have often been juxtaposed against Hispanic crime, with Hispanics having a higher rate of poverty and criminal gang membership, but a lower propensity for violence. I think this can be adequately explained by a lower rate of single-parent families, 31.2%, and a strong cultural tradition of deep familial ties, but I do not have any data or studies to validate this. So, why do black people commit more crimes? To be specific, young black men commit more crimes, far more than any other racial demographic. They are much more likely to come from an unstable, impoverished, single-parent, matriarchal household. They are more likely than young white men to lack a strong male role model. They are much more likely to seek acceptance in gang culture, leading to the acquisition of a criminal record, reducing employment prospects, and putting the individual into a downward spiral of poverty, which further incentivizes criminal behavior as a source of income. If you don't mind me speaking in more generalized terms and giving my opinions on the matter, it seems to me that these people are victims of circumstance. For many black men, the deck has already been stacked against them from their earliest days. They suffer from many societal handicaps that are beyond their control that directly affect their cognitive abilities and emotional well-being, and find themselves with reduced options from social stigma attached to poverty before any other factors need to be introduced. So I know what you're thinking. This is the white man's fault, isn't it? And the answer is no. There is no one group at which the finger can be pointed with any reliability to say, you did this. If I make conjecture, I think the fact that black people can be visually distinguished from white people has provided an intellectually lazy trap in which it's easy to fall. It's very convenient to self-validate by inventing excuses for one's own poor choices to project the responsibility for them onto mythical concepts like white supremacy and dismiss other successful black people as Uncle Toms. Not only does it allow one to place the blame on an entity that can never refuse it, but...
Alrighty. Alright, I hope you enjoyed that. And I want to thank my guest, author Marnie Grundman. And she knows all about being a runaway. If you've been a runaway and you know some, or you know someone that has ran away, you probably go on Amazon and get her book and just put her name, Marnie Grundman, up into the address bar or the text bar. And her book, I'm going to go check it out. So you should check it out too. If you are a reader, if you like to purchase books, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, if you go get her book, give it a review. A lot of people don't like to write reviews. They'll download your book like hell, but they will not give you a review. I just don't know. I don't understand why. But I do know you cannot write a review unless you have an account with Amazon. Maybe that's one of the reasons. I don't know. But also check out my, I got some books up there too. So check out what I've done so far It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Okay, you're listening to the George Waddle Jr. Show. It's all about making the world a better place one show at a time. This is the talk of our times. All right, our greatest weakness lies in giving up. And that is the most certain way not to succeed. Always try one more time. And that's true. When you think about giving up, try one more time. You never know. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas, everybody. This is it. This is the Christmas season for giving, for helping. You know, I mean, this is it. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are giving of themselves, their time, their money to those who are unfortunate, those who are living in shelters, those who have been burnt out of their homes, those who are living on the street. I mean, people are coming out. They're pouring out their hearts to those in need. This is it. But you know what? This shouldn't just happen around Christmas time. This should happen almost every day. Pouring out your heart to those who cannot, especially families. And, you know, it's just a great thing to see people giving of themselves, their time, their effort in order to make someone else Christmas happy. And the thing about it, some of these people are forfeiting their own Christmas to make another family Christmas a little bit brighter. And I just think that's great. I think that's wonderful. And it's just warming to think that. And I want to say again, Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy New Year. Yeah, it's going to be 2017. We're all going to be a year older. Some of us want to see it, and some of us don't want to see that.
Ladies
extra
and gentlemen,
year
the George
on.
Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived.
Bombs begin to fall. Anyone who never saw. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a claw.
Oh, yeah.
All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We got about 1 minute left into the show. I'm going to thank everybody for listening. Thank my callers. And I want to say once again, I'm freezing, folks. It's cold. It's something to do. My mouth is frozen. What can I say? Join me tomorrow. Okay, someone just whispered in my ear 90 seconds. So I want to say join me tomorrow, same time, 6 o'clock to 7:30. On the George Wilder Jr. Show, we have interesting guests, a lot of things to talk about. 347-857-1762, the George Wilder Jr. Show. And I hope you will join me tomorrow on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thank you for all your input, your kind words and, you know, whatever, criticism of the George. But I hope you guys join me tomorrow. It's been great. It's been fun. Bye-bye, everybody.